Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am great.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
All right, first up in controversies and non-controversies, I would like to present to you all one of the greatest film advertising fumbles of all time. Now, advertising movies is tricky, right? You have to figure out what sort of audience you're trying to attract. You got to target them, and then you got to activate them, right? It's not easy. It's a real science. People who love movies, I don't think, have really thought enough about the ways in which the rise of social media and streaming and the decline of traditional TV and the advertising model have impacted how movies get sold to audiences. You know, I hear parents of children all the time, for instance, tell me that they had no idea some new kids movie is coming out, despite the fact that they have kids of the correct age that would enjoy this thing or liked previous entries in the series. It's wild out there. I think things are very, very weird and bad and interesting. But that's a segment for another day. The point is, it's hard to get audiences to show up, right? A lot of thought and a lot of care goes into ad campaigns. Special companies exist solely to cut ads and to cut trailers. Entire teams vet them before sending them out to other teams who figure out how to target audience with their teams. It's a science, folks. It's a science. And that brings me to Megalopolis, which is Francis Ford Coppola's self-financed, long-gestating project about a near-future version of America that's kind of like Rome, I guess. It has statues that move and talk, and Adam Driver, he's an architect. I don't know what's going on. It looks weird. It looks weird. It looks really interesting. I'm excited for it, but that's because I'm a weirdo, and we get excited for all sorts of things. But it comes out in a month. And if distributor Lionsgate and producer-director Francis Ford Coppola hope to recoup the investment in this film, which is sizable, they're going to have to get people who aren't weirdo film critics like me excited for the picture, which means trailers. And the new trailer was really just wonderful. On the heels of the film receiving some bad notices at Cannes, the trailer led off with Lawrence Fishburne introducing quotes of old negative reviews of Coppola movies that are now considered classics by saying that true genius is often misunderstood. That was the line from the trailer. Did you know, for instance, that Pauline Kael criticized The Godfather as, quote, diminished by its artiness, end quote? Did you know that John Simon called Apocalypse Now, quote, a spectacular failure, end quote? Did you know that Roger Ebert, the great Roger Ebert, called Bram Stoker's Dracula, quote, a triumph of style over substance, end quote? None of that happened. Oops. None of those quotes are real. There were some murmurs when the trailer was released. It's funny, a friend texted me to say that he didn't think the quote from Kael, at the very least, accurately captured the spirit of her review, which was famously a rave. And he was like, I'm pretty sure John Simon wasn't at National Review when Apocalypse Now came out, as was cited in the trailer. Our friend Bill Giabiri, he did some digging around and found out that he could track down precisely zero of the quotes, which led to Lionsgate pulling the trailer, apologizing for the error, and saying, no, none of these were right. Our bad. We're going to figure out what's going on here. Turns out, some intern or something plugged in negative review of The Godfather by famous critics or some such into ChatGPT or the equivalent, and it spat out a bunch of wholly invented quotes. I love this story. I love this story for a couple of reasons. One is that it calls back to a better time when critics and filmmakers were happier to fight with each other a little bit. Everybody's too friendly now. Social media makes everybody too nervous to get in spats. We need more spats. Another reason to love this story is the suggestion that critics matter at all. And that's why Coppola is obsessed with the mixed reviews for Megalopolis out of Cannes. If people don't show up for Megalopolis when it hits theaters in a month, I think it's going to have less to do with the maudits out of Cannes and more to do with the fact that no regular audiences have heard of this movie. Also, that Coppola's recent run of films like Twixt and Chetro don't exactly inspire confidence in the normal cinema goers, if they've even heard of the films, which they probably haven't. The final and biggest reason I love this story is because it confirms all of my prejudices about over-reliance on AI slop and how it will be the downfall of both the film industry and society in general. Peter, where's your AI god now?
My AI god is making up fake Sonny Bunch quotes.
I knew it.
This is I actually asked ChatGPT about you, and it said that it gave me 5 points about Sonny Bunch. It said that you're known for your appreciation for genre films, that you have consistently critique Hollywood's political messaging, that you defend big budget blockbusters, that You have a great interest in the business of Hollywood, and you also have some skepticism of prestige films. I'm not sure I totally agree with that.
I think that one's wrong.
But 4 out of 5 is pretty good, and ChatGPT tells me that these perspectives make Sonny Bunch a distinctive voice in the world of film criticism, as he balances a love for cinema with a critical eye on the industry's trends and tendencies. So that's what my AI god is doing right now. It's explaining Sonny Bunch to me, which I'm learning something every day.
What does it say about me, Peter? I bet it's much more confused about me.
I haven't asked it yet. I should.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute. All right. Peter, it's a funny story because it's like such an obvious and transparent mess up that everybody involved should be embarrassed. But I do think that there's something to, you know, it sets the stage for a broader discussion.
I don't think this tells us anything about AI, like about the usefulness or not that we didn't already know. And it doesn't really change a kind of fundamentally optimistic story that I subscribe to, because this is the same exact thing that happened all throughout the 1990s and into the aughts with internet citations. We are all of the exact right age to remember when it was prohibited by most teachers, at least in high school, to cite any source online. And in particular, they said when Wikipedia came out, you definitely can't cite Wikipedia because Wikipedia can be edited by anybody, by the crowd, by randos. You'll never know. They're anonymous, right? Like, you have no idea. It might be true. It might be totally made up. And guess what? Wikipedia is like, of course, it's not perfectly accurate, but literally nothing is perfectly accurate. Anything that attempts to tell you to sort of contain all information, right? Like Google isn't perfectly accurate. No newspaper, despite being very good in many cases, right? Like no newspaper is perfectly accurate with every single sentence or every single phrase that they publish. Nothing is perfectly accurate. And just because an information source in some cases might provide inaccurate information doesn't mean that the information source or the underlying technology is inherently bad. It means that people are using it improperly or stupidly. And that's the case with newspapers, with Wikipedia, with encyclopedias, with books, with the printing press, with absolutely any kind of technology or institution of knowledge production. That's the case with academia and peer-reviewed studies. Some of them turn out to be completely made up or totally wrong, right? Just absolutely there's not a source that you can point to that hasn't had a face-planting moment of like, wow, they just got that wrong. And just because AI got one wrong here doesn't tell you that AI is bad. It tells you that it can be misused. And it also reminds you, hey, if you're citing facts that you pulled from Claude or ChatGPT or whatever, you should check them with a second source. Do your basic due diligence. Journalists, at least, I think, know that. But people outside of the world of journalism who are in the knowledge production or fact sharing industry, which sometimes includes movie marketing, like, you gotta check this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, fine, but it does. What the very first thing you said about getting information from the internet is still, I think, true. It's you gotta be very careful. Like, I'm sorry, if somebody sent me an article quoting Wikipedia, I would send them the article back. I mean, like, Wikipedia is fine to use as a resource to find other primary sources. Like, there is a usefulness to Wikipedia, but if somebody sent me a piece with the line, according to Wikipedia, I would immediately throw it in the trash and I would tell them never to submit to me again. And this is the problem with AI, at least as it currently exists, is that it is pulling information from many dubious sources to just imagine. Like, this isn't the first time AI has just made up quotes.
Oh, yeah, it's right. There's clearly a lot of lawyers who are using AI to write their briefs. And so now, like especially like small towns and sort of lower level courts are having to deal with these briefs that are written by AI and cite completely non-existent, you know, other briefs or precedents or cases, right? It's like, what? But yeah. You know what? We've never actually known anything. And this is, it's not that there's no truth anymore. It's that there was never
nonsense.
Any truth.
That's, oh my God. This is postmodern nonsense. Alyssa, set him straight.
Oh my goodness. I still want to know what ChatGPT thinks of me. I'm going to be very curious about this until Peter answers.
Look it up while we're doing this, Peter.
But I think, you know, part of what gets to me here is that it seems to this incident is a great example of people fundamentally understanding what these large language models are and do, right? I mean, treating ChatGPT as like your Google butler, you know, is sort of operating under the assumption that sort of it's a fully knowledgeable, reliable assistant who you can trust, when that's just not true, right? I mean, it's like, it's the equivalent of turning to the guy at the desk next to you, you know, when people still went to the office and had desks and had people who sat next to them at desks, and saying like, hey man, can you just tell me three movie critics who, you know, said this about various Francis Ford Coppola movies, right? It's like, ChatGPT is like, it's a guy, it's not a god. And the sort of fundamental misunderstanding of what these models are, what they know, what they don't know, and what sort of guardrails they have on them is, you know, I think we're just going to keep seeing these screw-ups because people fundamentally have bought the hype, right? They are, you know, they're not, they're entities. They're not, you know, a cheat code that will miraculously do everything for you.
Yeah, can I just interrupt briefly? Because here's when I read the story and I started realizing, oh, they just put the things into ChatGPT. The first thing I thought of were all the people I have had tell me that college tests don't matter anymore because the kids just put the prompt into ChatGPT and they spit out essays that are, you know, nonsense and blah, and that's fine because really, what should they be doing? And I'm sorry, like, this is me getting on my old man hobby horse and yelling at the clouds, but we have an entire generation of students who are just coming out of school and have relied entirely on ChatGPT and the equivalents to, at the very least, help them and in some cases entirely do their work for them. And we are going to get more and more stories like this where people simply don't understand how to do the work. It's not hard to find negative reviews of these movies.
Yeah.
Like, I could go to there's a shelf of books behind me. I can pull five of them off right now and get you, you know, negative reviews of those movies. And it's not like I'm a professional librarian, you know? It's crazy to me that this happened.
It's just, you're just bragging about your bookshelf privilege.
Yeah, it's just...
I do have an amazing bookshelf.
Yeah. I think the thing that people fundamentally don't understand about these large language models and these tools is that teaching judgment is, in fact, extremely difficult. Like, I'm working on a project that involves writing like a very, very complicated prompt for large language models that involves trying to sort of quantify questions of editorial judgment. And it's very, very hard, right? Like, and so if you don't understand that ChatGPT, Claude, any of these tools, Grok, is just sort of set up to please you without understanding that humans might value sort of accuracy and reliability in certain ways. If you don't understand that, then of course people are going to keep having these bizarre screw-ups because they don't understand that they have to actually exercise judgment in place of judgment that these tools don't actually possess.
Peter, do you have the results for Alyssa yet?
I do. So it's a little longer, so I don't think I could read all of it, but ChatGPT gives me 6 points about Alyssa.
Ooh.
It says you focus on cultural and social commentary. You're interested in representation and diversity. You do a lot of analysis of genre and tropes. You engage with politics and policy. You critique media industry practices, and you support thoughtful storytelling. And so overall, your criticism is characterized by its depth and willingness to engage with the broader social implications of media. She brings a critical yet empathetic eye to her reviews, often advocating for a more inclusive and thoughtful approach to storytelling in film and television. That sure sounds like Alyssa Rosenberg to me. I'm just going to print that in my biography of you.
Quote.
I take everything back negative that I've said about ChatGPT. It obviously has just a totally refined sensibility and
superior taste.
Yeah, although it doesn't appear to know that I'm the letters editor of the Washington Post yet. So
we should ask ChatGPT to rank us. Rank the across the movie aisle host. No, don't do that. I don't need that. All right. I just want to take this back one step away from the AI stuff and say that I do find it charming that Francis Ford Coppola thinks critical opinion matters. Aren't you guys heartened by that? Aren't you thrilled that he's still worried about what the scribblers say about his movies and how important that is on the public's awareness of his film, his upcoming opus.
Yeah, the guy's a freaking legend. It's adorable. He should have some more confidence.
So ChatGPT ranks us in this order. Sunny is number one, and Alyssa is number two, and I'm number three, and now I hate ChatGPT.
Hey, it all worked out. The AI is good. Who knew? All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Lionsgate used a bunch of made-up quotes to get people excited for Megalopolis? Alyssa.
It's a controversy, obviously, and it's so dumb.
Peter.
It's a controversy, and it's very funny.
It's a controversy, but yeah, I'm starting to warm up to this AI thing. I don't know. It ranks us pretty well, I think.
Number one across the movie aisle host, Sunny Bunch.
Hey, I'm going to put that on my I don't actually have a Wikipedia page, but if I did, I would put it on there. All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode about the rise and fall of Obamacare. Not care, Obamacare. Everybody keeps wanting me to change Obamacare to Obamacare in all of my... autocorrects, but Obamacore, which is the cultural movement that defined the Obama years. What was Obamacore? What would Bidencore or Trumpcore look like? I'm kind of curious to get your guys' thoughts on that. But until then, on to the main event. Blink Twice, directed and co-written by Zoe Kravitz and starring her fiancé, Channing Tatum. Blink Twice opens with Frida, who is played by Naomi Aki, watching Tatum's tech bro billionaire Slater Kang apologizing for some unnamed transgression as he explains how he bought an island to get away from it all and has been donating millions to various causes as a way to make amends. Again, we're not entirely sure what for, but he's done bad things and he wants everyone to know he's very sorry. And to do that, he's giving them money. Because that's how you do it. Frida and her roommate slash co-worker Jess, who's played by Alia Shawkat, first work and then sneak into Kang's philanthropic bash at a museum. He's giving away a bunch of money. They catch his eye and his entourage's eye. And then along with a trio of other women are escorted to Kang's private island, where they enjoy fine dining, some mind-expanding drugs, and the ever-increasing sensation that something is wrong. Dangerous, even. Why is there dirt under Frida's nails? Where does Jess disappear to midway through the movie? What really is going on here? And how can Frida and her new friend Sarah, played by Adria Arjona, escape too? There's going to be some spoilers here as I try to explain why the movie doesn't really work. At least for me, I don't know about you guys. So sorry, can't avoid it. If you're worried about that sort of thing, log off now. We'll catch you after you've seen the movie. All right, you're gone. Good, great, here we go. My elevator pitch for this movie is basically like, what if Get Out, but instead of Black Lives Matter, it's Me Too, right? That's basically what's going on here. To wit, Kang and his buddies, who are played by Haley Joel Osment, Christian Slater, Simon Rex, Kyle MacLachlan, and the fresh-faced Levon Hawke, have essentially kidnapped this group of women and are sexually assaulting them every night while force-feeding them a regimen of drugs that wipes their memory every morning. They wake up none the wiser, unable to remember what day it is or how long they've been there, while the men go about their business as if everything is okay. The venom of a snake that's on this island that infests the island wakes the women up, and they try to determine just how to escape and or take their revenge. Blink Twice fails on the level of compelling plotting, particularly, again, compared to its most obvious reference point, Get Out, right? Jordan Peele's screenplay was a masterpiece of clockwork precision. Every plot point builds to the next. Every reveal is carefully set up before. It's, like, really well done, just as a matter of storytelling, cinematic storytelling. But Blink Twice is a little loosey-goosey with how all of this works, and it doesn't help that we spend a solid 30 minutes in the middle of the 100-minute runtime with these women just kind of losing any sense of how long they've been there, which is fine, but it also kind of destroys... One thing that kind of undermines is our ability to intellectually empathize with these women, right? Like, if you are a woman and you get on a private jet with a guy who was Me Too'd a year ago and you go to his private island and you give up your cell phone as the price of getting in, and then you do a bunch of mind-altering drugs that destroy your ability to understand the context of everything that's happening around you, I don't know. That seems really, really dumb. That's just a dumb thing to do. And without like a kind of better sense of escalating weirdness and tension, All we're left with is the ham-fisted social signifiers, and that's just not enough in a movie like this. I'm sorry, it just isn't. Another problem is that there simply isn't enough characterization of any of these people for us to care about them. The women are all interchangeably innocent, the men are all interchangeably evil, and I swear to God, at one point, one of the two women I haven't even named yet that are also with them on this island stands out of the pool, and I'm like, wait a second, that's not maybe from Arrested Development. Who is that? Has she been here the whole time? And the only reason the guys stand out at all is because they're faces we recognize. They're like famous actors. I'm like, oh yeah, I know him. I remember him. He's interesting. I don't know, man. I want to say one positive thing about Blink Twice, because I'm being kind of mean about it. I don't like being mean. That's not what ChatGPT wants from me. And that is that it looks very good. Kravitz and cinematographer Adam Newport-Barra did a great job of shooting the night sequences in particular. Like, the action is dark without being invisible, which is very hard to do these days. Nobody does it very well. This movie looks great. And there are other moments that look very good too. Like the fundraiser in the museum has this kind of blinding, sterile whiteness to it that calls to mind something like 2001 A Space Odyssey or other artificially clean environments. It gives a real feel for the whole sterility of the thing.
It's an odd choice. I've been to a few foundation galas in my life, and none of them look quite like that.
Well, you haven't been to any Slater Kang parties, my friend.
That's true.
I laughed out loud a couple of times. The movie has some good comic timing, but as a whole, it just doesn't work. It's like the most 2017 movie ever made. I mean, it really just feels like it's very specifically from a different era of concern and ideas and, you know, difficulties. But maybe I'm being too hard on it. Alyssa, what did you make of Blink Twice?
I don't think you're being too hard on it. I found this movie really frustrating. And you got at something that has been bothering me, which is the movie sets you up to kind of feel like Frida's not that smart at the beginning. And it's not just that she's flying off to drooling over this guy without us knowing either what he's done or sort of what's impressive about him, other than that he's played by Channing Tatum and he's rich. Her life is clearly just not really together. She's, kind of blowing off this catering job at a time when she doesn't have a lot of money. The movie sets her up to be kind of dumb and unsympathetic. And I wonder if it would have been politically sharper for the movie to suggest that Slater Kang, had gotten himself in trouble over something, sort of the way that, like, on the level of, like, this, the awkward date that got Aziz Ansari in trouble or something, right? Like, something where, the transgression is sort of, mixed enough that you can see why a bunch of women would be willing to go hang out with him, where you could see some of the sort of, maybe see the case for him being frustrated about what happened to him, but sort of refusing to tell us what happened kind of, it just leaves sort of this weird hole in the movie. And it also doesn't really allow the movie to engage with what it kind of tells us later, which is like that Slater and his sister, who, and I have to be honest, I did not really realize that Stacey was his sister for a lot of the movie. It's the character, played by Gina Davis.
That's his sister?
Yes, this was to be his sister.
See that? Okay. All right, yep.
The idea that they had been sort of really horribly abused themselves. And so the movie just, it has these lacunas that end up really undercutting its political commentary. And the way it ends, which again, spoiler alert, really do turn off the podcast and come back to it once you've seen it if you care about this sort of thing. The end of the movie involves Frida like brainwashing Slater and like taking over his company. And there is no, the movie totally skips over any scaffolding that would make this make sense. Like, the whole movie is kind of this dark fairy tale, but I don't think it is sort of abstracted or strange enough to quite get the viewer to just say, oh, we can like skip over all of the interim steps there in a way that doesn't quite work. And really what I found myself thinking most while watching this movie is that the comparison point is not even Get Out, it's Don't Worry, Darling.
Yes.
which is a movie that I think was kind of mixed on when we talked about it about a year ago, and yet that I have found myself thinking about a lot since, and that has really kind of grown in my estimation. And that is a movie that, you know, does end up giving you sort of the full horrifying backstory of what is happening without getting sort of too granular into, you know, how Chris Pine's evil mastermind set up this like lady kidnapping and brainwashing scheme. It does much more to explore, you know, or at least to reveal why someone might want to live in this kind of artificial paradise and, like, you know, mess with their own memories in the form of Olivia Wilde's character. It's stylish in many of the same ways. I think arguably this movie looks a little bit better, but it's, you know, it's again got a lot of style. And I think it probably has a better...
Don't Worry, Darling was, if I recall, shot by Matthew Labatique, who is just one of the great filmmaker, I mean, great cinematographers working today. And I mean, this movie is a little more sort of overtly stylish, but I do think Don't Worry, Darling looks very good, even though it is a mess of a movie.
Yeah. And I think Don't Worry, Darling has definite problems, but it has really stayed with me despite those problems. And I do not think this movie will in the same way. I mean, I also think it's really hard to compete with Florence Pugh acting wise. And I don't think Naomi Mackie is as good as Florence Pugh in this movie, not by a long shot. And so I just, you know, Angelica Bastian over at Vulture reviewed this with a headline that's something like, you know, when you're so charmed by Channing Tatum, you forget to eat the rich. And I kind of think that's a good description of this movie, which is just not nearly as biting as it thinks it is. And I think part of the problem is that Tatum is himself just, you know, very charming, right? And I actually think he does quite good work here at, you know, suggesting something sort of curdled and rotten underneath the surface of that charm. I think this movie, I will be curious to see what he does with his career sort of long term, because I think being charming all the time can get boring, and he clearly is interested in doing some more challenging work. But this is not a movie that works overall at all. I really don't think it lands.
The best moment of acting is also like kind of the biggest, showiest moment of acting toward the end, when Tatum is saying over and over again, "I'm sorry." Like the different inflections of "I'm sorry," what it actually means to say "I'm sorry" and not mean it, which is like, again, it's kind of interesting, but it also, it's just such an obvious, again, social signifier. Like this, every moment in this movie feels like it is designed to reflect an argument being made somewhere else at some other point in time. And in that case, it's not enough to say "I'm sorry" or give money. You have to, you know, make amends, whatever. And like, okay, fine, I get the point, but it's still not compelling as drama. Anyway, Peter, what did you make Blink Twice?
So I also had problems with this movie, just like you guys. And I want to zero in on what I think is actually just the biggest problem in terms of why this movie doesn't work as a movie. Forget in some ways the social commentary. Both of you have talked about the slowness of the second act, the way that Frida seems like, Alyssa, like you said, maybe we're supposed to think she's kind of dumb even, which I actually don't think that's the intention of the movie, but it kind of comes off that way because it's not clear why she's making the big choice that she makes to get on that plane. It seems sort of ill-advised. And then when she gets to the island, she stops making choices at all. And you combine that with the lack of characterization for basically all of the characters. I mean, can you tell me one thing about Christian Slater is in this movie and he has a bunch of screen time and you don't know a damn thing about him except that he takes photos with a Polaroid and wears that fedora.
He's got a hat.
That's it. It's fedora and Polaroids. That's it. It's not a character. It's just, and it happens to be Christian Slater. So you remember that it's Christian Slater. So you know absolutely nothing about him. And then you combine all these things and what you end up with is a movie in which the protagonist, who is supposed to be the person who kind of has an awakening and in a, you know, feminist revenge scenario, for so much of the movie, she has no agency. And not even no agency, no goals. Like, what's she doing there is a quest, right? Like, does she plan to just sort of hang out until Until what? Like, is what is like, there is this suggestion that maybe her plan at the very beginning is to try and snag Slater King, you know, the and get herself a billionaire boy, right? And the movie does occasionally come back, touch on this concept of, oh, we're putting women, you know, in competition with each other. They're supposed to fight for men, and that's, you know, that's a bad thing, right? But it doesn't develop that. It doesn't really make that idea doesn't cohere at all. And so you just end up with a movie in which the whole second act, which is, you know, the bulk of the story, your protagonist doesn't want something specific, isn't going for something, doesn't have a goal. And without a goal and without a drive and without agency, you just don't have a movie. It's I think, stylishly and interestingly shot at times. I think there are some performances that are maybe not great, but at least a little better than the quite weak script, which just doesn't give the characters nearly enough to do. But without that, without any kind of drive in there, you just lose interest, because you have to, for a viewer to want a protagonist or a character to win, or frankly to lose, for that character has to want something. They have to have a desire in their heart that they are trying to achieve, especially in the second act, in the middle portion of the film, because otherwise, what are you rooting for? You're not rooting for anything specific to happen or against anything. And there's nothing to root for or against here for 35 or 40 minutes of this movie. And it just kind of starts to drag until you get to the third act. And the most interesting thing in the third act is actually not the spoiler that we have already heard about, how Frida ends up scheming to get to use the mind control, or I guess what, memory wiping drug on Channing Tatum's character to get his company. The most interesting thing about it is she was there a year before, and this has happened again. And she had all of this wiped from her brain completely once before. So this is a repeat offense. So that's a really interesting, just from a narrative perspective, idea. You can see, of course, what they're trying to do with the social commentary. But why was this movie not, why was the twist not that she knew she was there and was scheming the entire time to get this revenge and to get his company back? And again, that, like, if that's the twist, if that's the thing you see at the halfway mark, or maybe even the three quarter mark, but certainly, like, I would put that in at the midpoint of the movie, as you realize she's the one who is playing that, and she is organized, right? She has set them up to be suckers, because she knows that there's the memory wiping drug on the island. She didn't forget it, and it's been fucking haunting her for a year. It has been root, but she has decided, right? And she has taken power back, right? Like, that makes for a much more satisfying, first of all, feminist revenge story. Like, it does the thematics better. It also just makes for a better story with more drive to it, because suddenly you see that this person who has looked powerless for the first hour of the film, oh no, this person isn't powerless. They have been orchestrating this and using the way that they seem powerless as a way to gain power over the person who has hurt them. And that becomes a much more interesting movie. And it's right there. It's right there in the script. And they just couldn't develop this idea enough to actually give us a twist that mattered.
It also becomes potentially just a much nastier movie, right?
Yep.
Because it means that she sacrificed. I mean, it's fairly, it is really disturbing that both the character and the movie just sort of forget about Jess, who's like ostensibly her best friend, who she gets into this, who's like the person who figures out the truth, and who just gets murdered. And like, the realization that she got murdered is sort of horrifying for Frida, but it only matters in terms of Frida, right? Like, there's no investment in like justice for Jess or anything else. And if she was willing to sacrifice Jess for this goal, that makes it a much sort of deeper, nastier movie.
Or if she had realized that she hadn't thought that it would cost her that, right?
Yeah.
And it becomes this thing where, oh, I thought I had this great empowerment fantasy in my head where I was going to go back and get him. And no, when I got back and get him, it cost the life of a person I care about. Right? Again, there's just this idea, all of these interesting ideas are hanging at the edge of this film. And they're not just interesting ideas in terms of where you could take the kind of the Me Too parallels and the social commentary. There's a very good, very interesting, twisty narrative here that feels like maybe there even existed it somewhere in the script. Like, this thing feels like it's been cut up and reworked in a bunch of ways. It feels not long enough. I don't mean I wanted to watch 10 more minutes of this, but it feels like it's shorter than it's intended to be. And it's like there's a bunch there, but it didn't quite come together. That said, this is not a good movie. It didn't work, but I do think it's stylish and interesting enough, provocative enough that this is not one where I think, oh, Zoe Kravitz is never going to make a good movie. I think Zoe Kravitz might have it in her to make a very good movie. This sadly is not it.
I'm sorry. It's the opposite of provocative. The entire movie is set up to flatter people's prejudices. It's set up to flatter the preconceptions of the target audience. And like, here's one small example. Right towards the end of the movie, one of the male characters, it is revealed, has also been being drugged and is being made to forget about all of these things because he is opposed to the sexual violence, but he's not opposed enough to actually stop any of it. Right, he is criticized by Channing Tatum's character as not having done anything. And really, he's the worst sort of person. He didn't actually do anything to stop any of this. And so when he dies, it's kind of like, oh, he had it coming because he, again, just kind of allowed all of this to happen. But then there are on the island, there's like a series of kind of indigenous helpers, right? Guys who are working on the property, and also a maid who is kind of showing up constantly and is kind of a sinister figure at first. And then you realize that she's not sinister, blah, blah, blah. She is described in the credits as the badass maid. That is her. And I'm sorry, there's no actual moral difference between her and the character who we're glad dies. Like, she, you know, is she a badass maid, or is she, but you could not possibly have this movie where those characters are also hunted down by the feminist revenge squad. Like, that creates a lot of weird, awkward problems for folks. That would actually be kind of provocative. And instead it is, It avoids it very, very carefully. The whole movie is designed to be non-provocative, to flatter people's opinions.
I stand by what I said. This movie has very clearly provoked number one podcast host Sonny Bunch.
Well, It's not provocative. It's just boring. It's more annoying. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Blink Twice? Alyssa.
Thumbs down.
Peter.
Thumbs down, sadly.
Thumbs down. Not a good movie. Too bad. I was looking forward to this, too, but it's too bad. Okay, that's it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we will die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.